didn't dislike this procedure at all, that we would come in. Even was quite, I would say, satisfied with his success in Washington, we had worked out everything. And again, a certain disdain for Dr. Hammerschmidt, and Hammerschmidt at certain points where he drew his attention in his diplomatic way to Eden, there may be not exactly the consistency between our version and what he knew. He brushed him off unusually. And I remember then Hammerschmidt said, well, I have a different version from Washington about the summary of your conversations. That means they had talked to him while we were flying back.
Right.
And even said very clearly, you know, that is the summary and so on. And one of the use of these points, which Hammerschmidt had challenged in Eben's report on our agreement, later became points of contention between us and the United States, because Cabot Lodge did not present what we were given to believe that would be his response to Golda Meir's statement. It was much more ambiguous and less committed. Even on freedom of navigation. And so it's clear that Hammerschmidt was better informed, or that his diplomatic ear was better tuned to what the Americans really had in mind, in addition to his anger that this about the procedure. But I think he understood that it was not exactly our version. And then came really the crisis, because Golda Meir realized that what Cabot Lodge answered was not what we had reported, he would say in response to Golda Meir's statement. And she was very, very angry of Fink having been misled. And receiving information from confidential information that the Egyptian authorities would return to Gaza in opposition to what had been agreed to.
There was some confidential information to that effect.
We had that. So she was extremely angry about it, and she insisted that Eben should send a telegram to Ben-Gurion not to accomplish the withdrawal from Gaza, which was, the date of it was fixed for the 5th of March. And there was a scene which I described in my book very clearly. She was so, what America would say, mad. She threatened she would throw herself out of the window, and if she didn't even banged the door and left and so on. It would be very disrespectful to say I was left with the body. I mean, was at the school that, and had to quieten her. And to make it clear to her that Ben-Gurion knew what we knew, and the matter was too much advanced, and it wouldn't be good for her to intervene at this stage. It would be embarrassing if Ben-Gurion turns her down. It would be embarrassing to get Ben-Gurion, and things have done so. So we returned, so she asked me to go back with her to Israel, fuming. And Ben-Gurion knew how to handle these kind of hot potatoes until they become a cold issue. And he then said to her, well, really, it is a shameful what they have done, and you must return to Dallas in Washington and to tell them chapter and verse about this, how he has misled us and so on, but he knew, of course, that no effect whatsoever. So they asked me to go back with her, accompany her. So we had a meeting with Dallas, and Dallas, as he was clever, he went around and here looked and there looked. Then came the question of what kind of statement we made. Statement had to satisfy Golda in a certain way, but not to change anything. That was the mission on that. And it created quite some tension, of course, between Golda and Abba Ivan, actually. But there are realities in politics which you can't just change.
But the interesting thing is that there was a basis for her concern and for your concern. Not just that Lodge had said what was not expected, but also because you did have some information that indicated that the Egyptians weren't going to come back, as in fact they did.
We had, yes. We had received that they had informed. Yes, that they would send back their administration and even military.
But you did not think that the Americans knew that, or did you?
Oh, but we knew they knew.
Yes.
No, I think we were misled. There was, it was a Dallas way of doing things. You will hear more about it when you speak to the Secretary of Anthony Eden.
Yeah. Well, because...
By the way, I may interest me, you can ask him about that. Anthony Eden told me the following story. In order to save the situation, he had phoned Eisenhower that he wants to come over the same night before they take any decision after the crisis had erupted, and he wants to come the same night and to discuss the whole thing. And Eisenhower, in his gentility, said, of course, I think you must come over. And he said, and Eden told me, so he was happily leaving Donetsk to inform the parliament where a storm was brewing. He said, now be quiet, I'm going to Eisenhower and he will settle this whole thing. And he said, I was just entering my car, here the secretary may bear me out, when I was called back to the telephone and Eisenhower was on the phone again. And he said, Anthony, look, it's not convenient for me this week. I have a schedule, I didn't realize this, but I just can't do it this week. You know, you arrange these things first of all on your side there, and then you come and we discuss everything quietly. So he even said to me, well, when after Eisenhower had agreed that I should come, of course, Dallas intervened, and that was the voice of Dallas. And I said to me, I should never have gone back to the telephone.
Final question on that, and on everything. Dulles, what is your final judgment on what his efforts were? What was he aiming at in this particular crisis?
We had a centenary meeting at Princeton last year. I was at that time teaching there, so I participated in this. It was a kind of the meeting for the beatification of...
Yes, Eleanor Dulles arranged it, I think.
Yes, for the beatification of
Yeah.
She was there, Ellen Dulles, quite a show. And as a matter of fact, they wanted to get $2 million for the school, so why shouldn't they be nice to Dulles? And of course, this question came up. And I only, I think I made two interventions. And I say, I only know one thing, that Dulles, his dying days, regretted the political line he had taken. And he said so to Selwyn Lloyd. I should have not interfered with you, you should have finished the job. Why did you hesitate? He attacked the pound sterling, which is the strongest thing he can do to anything, strongest weapon he can use against Britain. And I mean, what official performance was anti-British. So sad old story about Dulles. This was apparently new to them, but it has been confirmed, I think, in all kinds of
memories. Pino has the same story.
Yeah.
Dulles told him.
You speak to the Selwyn Lloyd's secretary. No, I think it's confirmed. I think it's sort of to somebody, you know, I think. So it was the Dulles ambivalence. And I mean, he could have blinked his eyes at the time when he was so firm. Outwardly, he could have said to the British in a way, I don't know, get going, get going. So as he did, as a matter of fact, he didn't have any encouragement of the country. They had only obstacles. I think Dulles was a very complicated personality to give you a judgment in one sentence. And a mixture of so many strands. And I think he had thought that one could influence the Arab-Israel conflict in one way, which would bring about some kind of a reconciliation. Therefore, he made his trip to the Middle East before. On the other hand, he had challenged Nasser by withdrawing the offer on Aswan in a very abrupt way. So it's not clear to me how he really operated. And he had principles, and he had, on the other hand, expediencies. It's quite a matter.
Those are the really questions I wanted to put to you this afternoon. Unless there's something else that you would like to make a matter of this historical record on any of these subjects that we've covered.
No.
So just for me to thank you very, very much.
Thank you for coming.